And I think it's important to get some stuff on the table about how people feel and what the state is doing or not doing in this case.
YK Delta residents vent to Senator Begich about fishing closures. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, July 3rd. Good evening, I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, a teenager who was abandoned as a newborn returns to the place she was left in Sitka.
Apparently I made a little noise of some sort and he checked again and there's a little baby sitting in the bathroom sink and that baby was me.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Crowley, providing tanker escorts, fuel delivery, and energy support services to Alaskans for nearly 60 years. From Valdez to the North Slope, Crowley knows Alaska. CrowleyAlaska.com. Avtec is recruiting rural Alaskans for computer and network training with no cost tuition for qualified applicants. For more about the Village Internet Agent Program, call 1-800-478-5389. This message sponsored by Avtec, Alaska's Institute of Technology.
The International Whaling Commission voted 48-10 to uphold the catch limits for the Alaska subsistence whaling communities, which were set to expire this year. Alaska Eskimo Whaling Commission members were worried political debate over commercial and research whaling would interfere with their catch limit. APRN's Wendy Jonathan reports.
Relief overtook the Alaska Eskimo Whaling Commission in Panama this morning after the IWC upheld their catch limits. All 15 representatives are still in Central America and were only available by cell phone. George Nawook, the chairman of the AEWC, expressed his gratitude.
All the communities are behind us and there's a lot of support coming from each of the 11 whaling communities and lots of prayers and hope. So we're very happy.
The IWC passed the ruling this morning with more than the necessary three-quarters vote. Nawook says this is because of their extensive scientific research and data, as well as community support from all 11 whaling communities involved. Alaska's catch limit was packaged with two other subsistence whaling countries, Russia and St. Vincent, an island in the Eastern Caribbean. Nawook says that the 10 who voted against the subsistence whaling catch limit didn't think St. Vincent provided enough data. He says the IWC did not express any concern with the Alaska subsistence whaling. But in the midst of international debate on whaling, the AEWC was concerned that the IWC wouldn't get to their catch limits. In case they didn't, Earl Comstock, counsel to the AEWC, helped draft a piece of legislation that would require the U.S. to set its own catch limit when the IWC doesn't. That legislation hasn't passed, and while it seems unnecessary now, Comstock thinks it's a good backup plan and wants to continue to work on passing the legislation.
Certainly the fact that the IWC has acted, I think, takes away some of the pressure for it, but it still is just as a matter of policy, and, you know, this body has a historically short memory, so I'm sure in 6 years we'll be redebating many of these same issues. It would be a good idea to pass it, just to have it.
The subsistence whaling catch limit is set at 75 for the 11 communities represented by the AEWC. It won't be debated again for 6 more years, which is the longest period they have been given a blocked quota. The representatives from the AEWC will be traveling back from Panama later this week. In Anchorage, I'm Wendy Jonathan.
Senator Mark Begich was in Bethel yesterday for a roundtable discussion with subsistence fishermen about the record low king runs on the Yukon and Kuskokwim rivers. Representatives of state and federal fisheries managers were also in attendance. Begich says the state needs to do more for managing kings.
It was a very good meeting. A lot of stuff was aired, and I think it was important to get some stuff on the table about how people feel and what the state is doing or not doing in this case. And I think there was a lot of concern that the state is not putting enough resources into long-term management of the king run for subsistence users.
On a federal level, Begich has urged Secretary of the Interior Ken Salazar to increase next year's budget of the Alaska Subsistence Management Program. He's also working to sustain funding for wildlife and habitat management, which under President Obama's 2013 budget would see a cut of almost $3 million. But Begich says the state of Alaska needs to play a stronger role in fisheries management.
People gave some ideas, but they also recognize that the state of Alaska administration needs to step up to the plate and do more data collection and not just depend on the federal government for resources. It needs to be very clear what the state's responsibility is in ensuring that they have resources at the table to make sure the runs continue to come back.
As for the low king runs and any kind of disaster relief for fishermen, Begich says help could come from the federal level if the state doesn't act. The Air Force's decision to delay relocation of Eielson's F-16s does not end Alaska's concerns about military downsizing. The head of a consulting team hired by the state to develop a strategy for protecting Alaska installations says financial pressure remains on the military. Washington, D.C.-based consultant Steve Hijack gave a presentation to state legislators recently during a Joint Armed Services Committee hearing. Hijack laid out federal budget control acts approved last year and the potential for additional reductions to be triggered in 2013.
Today, we're looking at $478 billion in cuts between October 1 of this year to 2022. If sequestration kicks in, that goes over $1 trillion. That's dramatic.
Hijack stressed that it's up to Congress whether the sequestration cuts occur, but even without them, the Army will downsize by 80,000 and the Air Force by 10,000 people. Congress will also decide whether base realignment and closure rounds requested by the Secretary of Defense go ahead. Hijack said if there are BRAC rounds, Alaska faces a special challenge due to the state's high operational costs.
Energy costs and base operation support costs. Not our friend in the state of Alaska when you look at things from a BRAC perspective, because remember, it starts off in BRAC with the bean counters, not the strategic guys, not the operators, just the guys that sit there and go, what are the costs, what are the maneuver acres, you know, how many planes do I have, what's the age of facilities, they look at numbers.
Hijack urged legislators to find ways of reducing military operational costs, citing subsidized electricity rates as an example of what some states have done. He added that Alaska is among 20-plus states that have hired consultants to fight for their bases. Hijack's consulting team is scheduled to provide the state a strategic plan to fight military reductions later this summer. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, remembering better years for the Ship Creek fishery.
I've seen it where everybody be hooking up and we've been netting each other's fish, just having a good old time.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Think safety when out boating or doing activities near water. When boating, always wear a personal flotation device. Bring some kind of communication with you and do not overload the boat. Let family or friends know where you're going and when you plan to return. Find out more at AlaskaBoatingSafety.org and PledgeToLive.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium's Injury Prevention Program.
On a winter night in 1994, a newborn baby was found lying in a sink at Sitka's Thompson Harbor. 18 years later, that girl is now a young woman named Carissa Amron. She graduated from high school this spring, and last week she returned to Sitka. KCAW's Ed Ronco has more.
Carissa Amron is digging through her wallet.
Yeah, I'm a little fishing license. Ta-da. One day pass, pretty much.
You're official?
Yep.
Nice. And your king stamp?
Yep.
Cool. So what are you hoping to catch?
Just something edible.
It is the 18-year-old's second time in Alaska. The last time she was here, she was an infant, and the subject of an incredible story that began just a few feet from where we're standing. Shortly after midnight, on January 24th, 1994, Sitka Harbor employee Kelly Warren was making his rounds.
He opened up the harbor door just doing a regular bathroom check, and apparently I made a little noise of some sort, and he checked again, and there's a little baby sitting in the bathroom sink, and that baby was me.
According to that day's Sitka Sentinel, Carissa was wrapped in a t-shirt and had just been born. She was light, 4 pounds, 12 ounces, the newspaper reported, but healthy. Authorities never found her birth mother. Carissa says she knew the basics growing up, that she was adopted, that she'd been left by her birth parents, but not a whole lot about where and when until just recently. In Sitka, she had a chance to meet some of the people who rescued her and visit the bathroom sink where she was found, as well as the hospital that treated her. She says the trip has been emotional, but she's also pretty matter-of-fact about the whole thing.
My past is my past, but my future is what I look forward to. So, I mean, that's not knowing more about my past isn't going to change who I am or who I've become. So, I mean, It's just nice to know. I've always wondered, so.
Okay, so let's talk about that. What's in the future? You've graduated high school.
Yeah, I'm going to go to Flagler College down in St. Augustine. I'm going to major in fine arts and then move on to zoology. Both have always been an interest for me.
Yep. You're going to find a way to kind of marry those two concepts?
Yeah, because one of the main subjects of my drawing is usually an animal of some sort. And I've grown up around animals. I lived really close to a creek, so I was constantly in the woods, in the mud, doing something nature-related. So I just started eventually putting that into art as well. So
Carissa's parents, John and Karen, adopted her when she was 3 weeks old.
And it was pretty quick. We didn't have a whole lot of notice, so we had to do as best we could. We went shopping at Freddy's and Juno to get as much as we could. And what we couldn't get, our church members came up with. And we were able to put together a nursery pretty fast and get it stocked with everything we would need for a child. I mean, normally you have 9 months to find this stuff, but we only had 3 days.
Yeah. And did you know the story before when you adopted her? I mean, did you know?
Yes, we knew exactly who she was going to be. And
I imagine it was in the news at the time.
It was in the newspapers in Juneau as well here in Sitka. So yes, we knew exactly what you knew.
Karen Amrine.
It has been a wonderful, wonderful 18 years. Couldn't ask for a better child, couldn't ask for a harder worker, couldn't ask for a better student. She's just been a dream child, our miracle little girl.
Carissa's parents say that they have been amazed at how many people they've reconnected with, even during just their first day in Sitka.
We walked over to the fire station, and the person behind the desk was Roberta White, and she was on the run that night. So she didn't get to pick her up or hold her or anything, but she was on her run, and she just took over and started notifying people and pulling up names of people and getting phone numbers for us so we could call, and it was just amazing.
Carissa agrees. She says she never really asked a lot of questions growing up, but now that she knows the full story, in her words, it is surreal.
It was the middle of winter. Anything could have happened, but the best outcome happened, and I ended up being safe and getting adopted by great people. And I mean, a million things could have gone wrong, but everything went right.
This is Ed Ronco in Sitka.
The refugee settlement office that serves members of Delta's Slavic community is closing. As KUAC's Tim Ellis reports, the influx of immigrants from Russia and other Eastern European nations that's boosted the area's population by nearly 40% over the past 20 years is slowing.
The old Slavic hymn reflects a mood that may have been a bit more melancholy than usual at the 6th annual observance of World Refugee Day at Delta City Park. Perhaps because the 50 or so immigrants who got together on June 21st knew that it may be the last time they commemorate an occasion that's important for Delta's Slavic-speaking community. Most members of that community came here as refugees, fleeing religious persecution in their home countries that formerly were either part of the old Soviet Union or nations dominated by the Soviets.
I am from Belarus, but I live in Kyrgyzstan last time. In Kyrgyzstan, life was very terrible. Right now, political situation more terrible because not Christian.
That's Anna Janssen, who was born and raised in Belarus and came to the United States in 2001 from Kurdistan. The 62-year-old Janssen says the Muslim majority leadership of that Central Asian region made it hard for her to practice her Christian beliefs. Another refugee, Vera Gorban, says she remembers her Ukrainian family being evicted from their home when she was a child after authorities discovered they were Christians. Gorban told those at the Refugee Day gathering that she's grateful that the United States opened its doors to all the refugees.
Not just healthy, young, and rich people. This country invited all who were persecuted.
In all, some 2,000 refugees and immigrants came to the Delta area over the past 20 years and now constitute about 40% of the area's population. But the flood of immigrants to the area has now slowed to a trickle. That and the shrinking local population of elderly immigrants has convinced Catholic Social Services officials that it's time to close the Delta Refugee Assistance Office. Karen Ferguson, the agency's state refugee coordinator, says the last of the federal grants administered by her office is being diverted from Delta to support the program offered out of the Anchorage office, where the need is now greater.
We still are receiving plenty of newly arrived refugees in Anchorage. The only reason we used to receive them in Delta Junction was just because they were connected with families, but all the families have sort of closed their loops. Every family who was trying to get family members has basically gotten them or, you know, a dead end, or they decided not to come.
Gorban is the last of three staffers who once worked out of the Delta office, and she'll be laid off at the end of September. She says the Delta Refugee Office closure means this year's World Refugee Day observance may be the last because the office coordinated the local event over the past several years. The office closure will mean less assistance for local elderly refugees in finding health care and other benefits, but the local Slavic-speaking community will still have the network of family, friends, and church that has taken root in the area over the past couple of decades, a network that's growing as the first generation of children moves on into their own homes and on to their own lives. The new generation includes 21-year-old Oksana Shostiko, who was born in the Ukraine and whose family came here 11 years ago to escape grinding poverty in the old country.
We had a big family, we didn't have any income, no money, nothing.
Shostiko says the local and extended immigrant support networks were the main reason that her family and many others have been able to make the long, hard trip to this place in Alaska that they now call home.
I just think that everybody who's here, and especially the older people like seniors, they see how it is right here, right now, and what opportunity they have and a blessing to live here.
In Delta, I'm Tim Ellis.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Doyon Limited, celebrating 40 years as Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. For thousands of years, the coastal residents of Arctic Alaska have depended on the polar bear for sustenance, utilitarian, and spiritual purposes. The Alaska Nanook Commission was formed to ensure that current and future Alaska Native subsistence hunters will be able to continue to harvest this important resource. The Alaska Nanook Commission, along with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, would like to hear from subsistence polar bear hunters. Learn more at AlaskaNanookCommission.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Nanook Commission.
There's a new plan for managing bus and other traffic on the road into Denali National Park. The Park Service has released the plan and an environmental impact statement following 4 years of studies and meetings. The process looked at numbers and schedules for the buses that move visitors along the 92-mile Denali Road. Park Service spokeswoman Chris Pfister says the preferred alternative allows for some increase in traffic.
Basically, we're changing from an overall annual limit of vehicles on the park road to a daily limit and doing the scheduling so that we're not going to have, you know, these, you know, clumps and gloms of vehicles.
Pfister says the new plan better accounts for all park road use, including by contractor and service vehicles, some of which weren't counted in the past. Pfister says the proposed daily limit is 160 vehicles.
It's less than the highest recorded daily vehicle count, but it provides an opportunity for an overall modest seasonal vehicle increase.
She says the new system is based on studies and modeling to balance wildlife protection and visitor experience.
That we're not having so many vehicles on the park road that it's impacting animals being able to cross the road at points. I mean, particularly the sheep are very sensitive to that, but also giving that perception to the visitor that they're out having this more wild type experience, and they're not going to run into a place where they're going to see, you know, half a dozen different buses all at the same place.
The final Denali Road Vehicle Management Plan is out for public review through July 29th. More oyster farms are opening up in southeast Alaska. It's part of an effort to create jobs through tribal businesses and small communities. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
I'm going to be making an oyster with a rhubarb shooter. It's going to start with about a cup of water, a third of a cup of brown sugar. So a simple syrup is one cup of water.
Robert Kanine creates a unique taste blend using a common southeast plant and shellfish straight from the farm. The noted seafood chef shared his recipes during an Oyster Fest held alongside the Southeast Native Cultural Event Celebration 2012. Kaneen wants to encourage his fellow Alaskans to try out and experiment with oysters.
While they're not indigenously found here, I think it's a great opportunity to grow a beautiful flavored specimen. I mean, they're just amazing, nice, crisp, clean, subtle flavors. They're just really, really tasty, very subtle on the brine, and I mean, they're just really amazing.
Kaneen has been chef of the Seven Glaciers restaurant at the Alyeska Resort, or so in downtown Anchorage and other popular spots. He's Klinkit, originally from Petersburg, with family ties to Sitka. He works with the Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute and is part of a region-wide effort to promote oysters from tribally owned shellfish farms.
The Alaska brand, the mystique behind the Alaska brand, always creates market opportunity for you.
Russell Dick is president and CEO of Ha'ani LLC. That's the Sea Alaska Corporation subsidiary developing new Southeast businesses, including oyster farms.
Everything we have in production today could get sold into the Alaska market easily. And, you know, as we look to expand, we certainly want to reach out in the other domestic markets and potentially internationally if the logistics make sense and the economics make sense.
Sea Alaska doesn't own oyster farms, but the Juneau-based Regional Native Corporation has formed partnerships with shareholders and tribal governments in Yakutat, Cake, Angoon, and Heidelberg. It's not easy work.
Sometimes it's hard to get up and go out there because it's blowing 40, 50 knots and it's snowing.
Joy Klushkin left her job as business manager of Yakutat School District to become an oyster farmer. That was 2 years ago.
I'm still in shock when I come up to a table and I see that my oysters. I'm like telling my husband, take a picture. I can't believe it. Those are my oysters.
Klushkin has about a half million of the valuable shellfish growing in her farm. She just made her first delivery of around 25,000 to Ha'ani's Oyster Fest. She and two other farms share an island about a five-minute skiff ride out of Yakutat's boat harbor. There's a lot of regional cooperation.
We've actually learned a lot and got a lot of information from others. It seems to be an industry that everybody is excited to promote.
Cindy Bremner is president and CEO of Yaktatquan, the community's village native corporation. It just harvested its first oysters and hopes to produce as many as 3 million a year.
So it's not like they don't want to share what they know with us because we're going to have a better oyster. It's an industry that seems to support each other is what I've felt, and it makes it exciting.
These are not the only shellfish farms in Southeast. In addition to oysters, Little Neck and Geoduck clams have been grown and sold. This is Ed Schoenfeld reporting in Juneau.
Anglers are usually packed shoulder to shoulder this time of year on the banks of Ship Creek in downtown Anchorage, but state managers closed the popular fishery over the weekend. Like many rivers and streams around the state, the King Run has been weak in Ship Creek in recent years. Even though the fishery is stocked, managers are worried about collecting enough brood stock for the hatchery upstream. APRN's Annie Fite caught up with some anglers before the fishery closed and has this story.
It's not exactly serene at Ship Creek. There are trains passing through nearby, airplanes constantly buzzing overhead, and trucks accelerating on an adjacent road. But that doesn't seem to bother Charlie Bunch. On a recent afternoon, Bunch is relaxing in the sun on a rocky section of the muddy bank of Ship Creek.
I'm going to try to lure a king salmon out of this mighty Ship Creek today.
Bunch has been a regular at Ship Creek for 9 years now and says the fishing is especially slow this year. He's caught two fish in the last month. His friend, Joe Delia, has reeled in only three, but remembers much better years.
It's really good fishing when the fish are in. I've seen it where everybody be hooking up and we've been netting each other's fish, just having a good old time. It's close to town here. You don't have to spend a bunch of money and gas running off somewhere else. We just have a good time, help each other out, and some good-looking fish come in here, fresh out of the ocean over there.
In a good year, anglers catch 6,000 kings in Ship Creek. In recent years, that number has fallen to around 2,000 fish a year. Dan Bosch is the state biologist who oversees the Ship Creek fishery, which is stocked with hatchery-reared salmon.
The same thing that we see in the wild fisheries, which are depressed, king salmon fisheries, which are depressed area-wide, our hatchery fish are depressed too. And you know, we know how many fish we put in here. We know we're putting in good smolt. So whatever's happening to both the wild and hatchery fish, it's happening out in the marine environment.
The state just replaced the hatchery that supplies the Ship Creek king salmon. Bosch calls the new facility state-of-the-art and says there's nothing like it anywhere in North America. He expects the new hatchery to start producing better king runs at Ship Creek, but it will take a while, about 4 years. In the meantime, Bosch says some anglers have still been able to catch fish in recent years.
Those who are patient and those who not a fish for these fish will catch fish. I know people that came last year, when everybody's complaining about the fishing, I know anglers, you landed more than 10 fish here last year.
Bosch appreciates that the Ship Creek fishery is easily accessible to Anchorage residents. He says people show up on foot, by bus, and even in taxis.
I remember one year I was on the other side checking licenses, and I see this kid walk up, on his first cast he caught a king salmon. And he was a youth, so he didn't even, you know, he was 15 years old, didn't even need a license. All he had, but he had his harvest record card, and he was signed it right off. But, I mean, that's the kind of thing that you can see when the fishery's going strong. So that's what we all look for as fisheries managers. We want to see kids, whoever, catching fish.
On this day, though, it's difficult to find someone who is catching fish. But I finally locate one beaming angler in the parking lot, standing with friends behind a red pickup truck, fishing pole in hand. His name is Big June Leota.
But when I walked down to only about 15 minutes, I had one right in the mouth, but it's probably about 15, 20 pounds. But I give it away.
So what's your secret?
Just be confident and, you know, just don't think about anything else. Just go down fishing, have fun.
Sound advice. And even though the king salmon fishing is over for the summer, anglers will be able to test their luck again when the coho fishery opens on July 14th. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Matthew Smith in Nome, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Ed Ronco in Sitka, Tim Ellis in Delta, and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau. APRN's Wendy Jonathan reported from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station.
Do you know a nonprofit executive or tribal leader who is at risk for job burnout? We'll nominate them for a Rasmussen Foundation sabbatical, which provides paid time away for personal renewal and growth. Go to Rasmussen.org for more information, but don't wait. Nominees must complete an application by October. This message sponsored by the Rasmussen Foundation.
Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health, and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
You can find APRN headlines and more online at alaskapublic.org. Local, national, and international news, upcoming events, and statewide community conversation. alaskapublic.org, connecting you to Alaska one story at a time.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.